So I specifically wanted to talk about Orphan Works challenges. And I wanted to start out with this, which is a quote from the Apostle Paul talking to people in Athens about their statue to an unknown god. And I thought this was interesting. I was at a conference a few weeks ago where Ariel Katz, a law professor from the University of Toronto, talked about the copyright culture that we live in and this dogma that sort of pervades society that when we use copyrighted works, we have to get permission. I could have thrown up the picture that all of you see when you play a movie at home on your DVD player, the thing that says that unauthorized reproduction of this work is an infringement of copyright, and you'll be liable for $250,000 or whatever it is, and you'll be sent to jail. We have this idea that we have to get permission for everything, and statements like that really reinforce it, even though, as Brandon just explained, we have some rights and we have some exceptions to those exclusive rights of copyright owners that allow us to do things without obtaining permission first. And so Ariel Katz took this and he kind of put a religious slant on it, and he compared it to going to the church and buying indulgences, which I thought was very interesting. And we have this idea that even when we're making a copy of something where we can't find the owner and we're making a productive use of it anyways, we feel like we have to pay penance and we have to buy an indulgence for these types of things, which I thought was a great analogy. And then I came across this, and it really is the case that sometimes we end up with Orphan Works in particular stifling innovation and kind of worshiping and paying tribute to rights holders that are nowhere to be found and in fact probably don't exist in a lot of cases. So with that in mind, I was going to talk about orphan works. And the basic definition of an orphan work is works whose owners can't be located and therefore we cannot ask permission to use them. There are lots and lots of orphan works. I searched far and wide to find statistics or estimates for how many orphan works exist in the sound recording collection area. I could not find any, and part of the reason for that is it's difficult to tell. As we looked before, you can have multiple owners, multiple sets of laws that can apply, different foreign law, US law, state law. There are owners of the underlying work, there's owners of the sound recording, there are owners of the lyrics that are involved in that underlying work, if there are any. So it's really difficult to put all of those pieces together and find the rights holders that you need to get permission from to do something like digitize a work and put it up online. So just to give you an idea, in a collection that has a pretty good idea of what is sitting in it, there are lots of orphans. So this is a picture of the Hathi Trust, which is a digital library of about 10 million volumes. And these are mostly print monographs, and they have pretty good bibliographic data about what's in them, who the publishers are, who the authors are. And based on, these are some rough estimates, especially at the top end here, 1978, 1964 forward. But for the older works, the estimates are pretty decent that something on the order of 20 to 40% of the works in those ranges are considered orphan works, meaning that even if the Hathi Trust wanted to go license access for all of these and ask the owners if they could digitize them and put them up, they can't because they can't find the owners. So kind of extrapolating those numbers out, they come up with a sort of guesstimate that maybe 50% almost of the 10 million, of the in-copyrighted volumes that are in this collection are orphans and they can't find owners for them. That's locking up a lot of content if they feel like they can't go ahead and make access to those works because they can't get permission from copyright owners. So there are some general causes for the orphan works problem, and they kind of split into legal problems and practical problems. So in general, copyright has eliminated formalities under the 1909 Act. It used to be that to obtain copyright protection or to maintain copyright protection, you had to renew after a 28-year term. It also was the case that you had to put a notice on your copyrighted work. We've also, since the 1976 revision, have liberated the rules in terms of who can own copyright and sue based on those ownerships. So we've atomized the area of authorship, and that's been split pretty far. And then we've also layered copyright interests. And this is layering copyright interests is a particular problem for sound recordings because you have the underlying work and you have a all the possible contributors, the production team that goes into the actual sound recording itself, and so you have all of these people that have to be involved to get permission. And then some practical problems are the need to shift works to new formats. This is kind of new for books because people still look at books, but there's a desire to move those into the digital realm. And then we also have enhanced preservation, which means that more works are actually surviving, older works are surviving, and now we want to make new uses of those. So I was looking at all of these, and I realized that for sound recordings, all of these are magnified by about 10. It's really, really bad, and that makes the orphan works problem really, really bad. Elimination of formalities, for one. Under state law, so for pre-1972 sound recordings, there are no formalities. State law just kind of applies. We don't even know when it applies or where it applies, but it just kind of sticks to things that we can't even hold in our hands sometimes. Extension of terms, state law in general is thought to last into perpetuity. California is the only one that I know of that has a limit on the term that it'll apply to. Which now, since we have the 76 Act, those rights will be cut off in a few decades. So eventually we'll get there. And then the layered copyright interests, like I already said, that is particularly bad for sound recordings because we have all of these different interests and groups involved. And then looking at the practical issues, sound recordings have always needed to be able to shift from one format to another over time. There are lots of obsolete formats that sound recordings are embodied in that are moved over time. And the need to shift works in those formats has existed since sound recordings have been created. But at the same time, they last for a long time. Somebody gave an example, I think it was, Peter asked what the oldest existing sound recording was, and someone said 1857, which is incredible that it's lasting that long. I mean, of course we have books that last that long, but 1857 means, especially if we're applying state law to that, we have something that's over 150 years old that still has copyright protection in it, which is just fantastic or something. So the orphan works issue has been lingering for quite a while. As you probably know, the Register of Copyrights studied the issue pretty thoroughly back in 2005 and 2006 and brought together a lot of different stakeholders to talk about what an orphan works solution would mean for them and how it might be designed. This resulted in some U.S. legislation that was proposed between 2006 and 2008. And basically the way that the Copyright Office proposed solving this problem was to say, if a user who wants to make a use of an orphan works makes a reasonably diligent search for the rights holder and still can't find that person, then we're not going to say that it's not infringement. We're just going to say that even though it still is infringement, there are no or limited remedies available against that person. So if the owner later does show up and decides to sue you, there will be very little incentive to do so because the things like statutory damages, which are these incredibly high awards, the Jamie Thomas example Peter brought up, I think she downloaded 24 songs or 30-odd songs, and she had a multi-million dollar judgment against her, and that was based on this statutory formula or the statutory set of damages that courts are supposed to award. And this remedy would have taken those off the table for orphan works users that go through a reasonably diligent search. There was a lot of consternation about what exactly a reasonably diligent search is, and this actually got pretty far. One bill passed the Senate, but it died in the House, in part because the Google book search settlement was pending, and the thought was that that would have something to say about orphan works or maybe solve some of these issues for print books. It certainly doesn't address sound recording issues nearly as much. So anyways, this was the proposed and preferred solution that existed for a while, but it didn't go anywhere. The EU has adopted a similar approach, although they're taking kind of baby steps. They're applying it to a specific category of works and a specific category of users, so specifically libraries, archives, museums, public broadcasters. and it doesn't really reach sound recordings in any meaningful way. So that's the EU approach. I'm going to kind of blaze through a few of these. The Canadian system is similar, except that it's a little bit more onerous in that it requires a reasonably diligent search or something like that, but at the same time, or before you actually make the use, you have to go to the copyright board and ask permission and then pay to get a license to use for that work, which is administratively very difficult because you basically have an administrative court hearing every time that you want to make a use of an orphan work. So that's the Canadian solution. And there's also this idea of extended collective licensing. So for sound recordings and music in particular, there are a lot of collecting societies that register works and then license them out. And there are these systems, especially in Nordic countries, that take the licenses that they have with their members. And by law, those countries have extended those license agreements to other works that are in that same kind of realm, that are like the works that their owners have. And they say, you as a collecting society can go license those out and give permission to users. So this is this kind of, we have to pay penance for what we're doing. We have to pay to somebody, so we're going to pay to this licensing company, even though we know that they don't actually own the rights that are underlying this particular work. So that has some obvious drawbacks. One, you're paying money out for nothing. Nobody actually owns these rights, and you're just paying it into a collecting society. But it also has some benefits. It's useful for mass digitization because you don't have to go to each particular work and do an analysis of who the rights holder is. You just pay. You throw money at the problem, and it goes away, or supposedly it goes away. So that's one of the benefits of extended collective licensing. It has some other issues like good governance. Whoever the collecting society is has to be really good with record keeping. It has to be careful who it's paying out to. And that's something that in the United States we haven't been traditionally very good at. We tend to lag in the world in terms of good governance and in terms of ensuring transparency for organizations like this. So that's extended collective licensing. And then there are some also technological solutions. There's the Accessible Registry of Rights Information and Orphan Works, ARROW. This is out of the UK, and it's basically a project to go through and track the rights. So you go and you do a search, and you try to figure out who the owner is, and if you can't find the owner, you put it in this database, and the database then alerts everyone else to the fact that you haven't found an owner for this work. And so you share the cost of doing those searches across many people. And then there's also this idea that we can avoid the orphan works problem through an application of alternative licensing schemes going forward. So one way to do this, and one thing that's already in place in a lot of places, is open access policies at universities, I think, are a good example, where they basically switch the norm of what access is to the works that faculty members are creating. So these apply specifically to journal articles, scholarly articles that faculty members write, and they say that the university, as a default, gets a non-exclusive license to make the work available to the world, to archive it and make it available. And that kind of switches the norm of the university and the rest of the world having to go ask permission from the copyright owner to a presumptive, yes, you can do this unless we say no. And so that's one application of these Creative Commons and open access policy type schemes. So that's kind of the layout of the land of what people are thinking about orphan works and ways to address the problems. And really the problems boil down to risk and uncertainty. We talked about this a little bit earlier this morning, that there's this kind of fear of using copyrighted works without getting permission. We can wait for them to go into the public domain. But for sound recordings in particular, that's not a very effective strategy since nothing's going to happen for another almost 50 years. So we have to be able to do something with these works, and we have to take into account the risk that we might be sued. So looking at the world of sound recordings and the world of the underlying rights that are in those recordings, I was thinking about what legal doctrines we can apply. We heard about Section 108, we heard about fair use, we heard about 110, the Teach Act, and all of these exceptions that allow users to do things with copyrighted works. And I concluded that it's not real clear that any of those apply and we can do anything under any of those. We have the idea that fair use is a constitutional doctrine and that it, or it fits into this constitutional scheme of protecting our First Amendment rights. So there is some room to argue that fair use should apply to state law copyrights. And so that's kind of a glimmer of hope there. But outside of that, I don't see much leeway in terms of making access to orphan works under state law or making it explicitly legal, meaning that you go and you have a really good legal argument for why you're doing something that's okay. That being said, I don't think that sound recording collections should forego making access to orphan works, because the risk for a lot of these collections is really, really small. And it's not, the legal risk is pretty small in terms of you could be sued, you could be infringing copyright, you could be doing something, you could be doing all of those things. But it's not clear that the consequences of doing that are so severe. So for one thing, state law generally doesn't impose statutory damages. So those $1 million awards against people who are downloading 24 songs online are unavailable. And instead, there will be actual damages, which requires proof of what the actual market is and the actual profits that are made off of these things. For most cases, those are gonna be like zero or $10 or some minimal amount that is not really something to be afraid of. So that's one thing under state law. The other thing is just the collections in general. We can prioritize and look at collections and develop strategies for who we think is gonna sue us and how they're gonna sue us. So for instance, using things that the RIAA is very interested in is probably not a good strategy in terms of your initial steps of digitizing orphan works. Digitizing things like the collections that FSU had, or Florida Atlantic. Those collections, at least on their face, seem pretty low risk in terms of the plaintiffs who are gonna show up and knock on your door and say, we're upset about this. So I had some fair use slides here, but I wanted to jump into an orphan work strategy for digitization and access. So the two questions that I think fit into what an orphan work strategy might look like is, one, will anyone object to this collection, to the digitized access to this collection? And two, what happens if they do object? So these sort of involve the law, but for the most part, they're just practical questions. This is just common sense stuff. You don't need a lawyer to tell you that you should stay away from stuff that the RIAA is really interested in because they have a reputation for suing people. So these are just some practical suggestions, and there are some other kind of things within, if we look at federal law, that we could leverage that come out more generally in an orphan works analysis. But looking mostly at older works, at pre-1972 sound recordings, where we have to deal, at least for the time being, with state law, we have to make these kind of practical risk assessments. One, will anyone object? And two, what happens if they do object? And so, I have a few minutes left. So I wanted to make this very workshop-y, because this is something that I can't figure out. I can't figure out how to do this. For your collections, I can't tell you who the people are who will object, and I can't tell you whether they will sue, whether they will be successful because they can prove that they own the rights and the works that they have. But I think that you all probably have a pretty good idea of who these people are and what a orphan work strategy would look like. And so I wanted to open it up for questions to ask, basically, how would you design a system that is low risk? What are kind of situations where you think you could go ahead and do things to enable access to works where you can't find owners? And let's talk. So any questions or comments on that? So that's my question to you. Who, I guess, looking at the first one, who's the most likely person to object, and how do you eliminate those or reduce the number of those works in your collection that you're starting to digitize that are orphans? No one wants this. You don't have to say names if you don't want. Sure.
Because we've had to deal with this at my institution in certain guises, but and sometimes it just came at us from the blue. We hadn't thought about it, but something that was a speech, which we already heard about, was, anyway, was reproduced for an exhibit, but then the heirs of, who was it? It was some famous general, and his grandchildren found out about that and go, oh, no, take it down. Well, we did, but you know, that was one of those things that we hadn't thought about. Similarly, there was an idea to digitize God Bless America, the music to it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very clear on the Irving Berlin site, and they even say money for any of this goes to the Boy Scouts. So of course, you know, you're not going to digitize that. They have it very specific on their website. This is our property, and the funds and benefits go to Boy Scouts. So who would want, like, we're stealing from the Boy Scouts? So I think, I mean, if you could do a little bit of research to see if there is some sort of copyright or some heirs to that.
Sure. Well, and that's good, because two of the lessons that I've learned looking at other collections are stay away from overly popular people. I mean, that kind of limits the usefulness of your collection, but at the same time, you avoid these estates that are very litigation happy and that have big names behind them. So that's one lesson. And I think another lesson is that we can investigate, we can do some basic investigatory work, not about the work, but about the people who we think might be interested in these kind of collections. So those are ones where I guess you know who the owners are generally. But for works where we can't find the owners, we can sort of take some cues from the works themselves. So if they are on the topic of something that is very controversial or something where someone who involved might still have an estate around that could bring a suit, those might be worth avoiding. And one other thing that you mentioned that I think is really important, what happens if they do object? Take it down. You know, just be compliant, be willing to work with people and say, okay, we will take it down for the time being, let us know what your rights are, send us some documentation about what you have, and we'll pay attention, because I don't think anyone here is really interested in exploiting the rights of people who actually own them and who actually care about the works that they control. The issue is taking advantage of rights where those owners can't be found. And so if someone does actually object, it's worth paying attention to their objection and listening to what they have to say. Now, sometimes they may just be wrong about what they have, and you have to be prepared to deal with that, too. They may not have rights. Their rights might have disappeared, and the work is in the public domain for some reason. But it's important to know that 90% of the time, you're not going to be sued. You take things down, and people are pretty happy about that.
David, we have a question from one of our online participants. You made a short statement about fair use and state law, and she wanted to know if you could unpack that a bit.
Sure. Well, I think what I said was largely along the lines of what Brandon said about fair use, in that we don't really know in most states if there is a doctrine of fair use. The case law is so thin that it just hasn't come up. There are one or two cases that talk about, I think in New York, fair use rights that exist there. But because we do have at least, multiple cases, but two recent cases from the Supreme Court explaining that fair use is part of our First Amendment free speech rights, that we have to have fair use to have full access to our free speech rights, we have to be able to read at least some of what fair use does into or over top of state copyright law. Because if we don't do that, then that means that state laws are potentially abridging our or reducing the strength of our First Amendment rights. So for that reason, I think that it's pretty clear that we have to have at least some of those rights. We might not call it fair use. It might go by another name, but we have to have some sort of analogous rights over top of state law copyright to be able to fully exercise First Amendment privileges.